I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome to a special edition of Buried Truths, a live show recorded in Atlanta. So since releasing Buried Truths, we've heard from so many of you about how it impacted and inspired you, brought history to life, and moved you to act. So Buried Truths Live was an opportunity for listeners to come together, discuss the story, and meet Isaiah Nixon's daughter, Dorothy. The conversation took place on November 28th at the Atlanta History Center. The seats were packed, and the audience fell in love with Dorothy all over again. So what you're about to hear is in three parts. First, a chat with the producer, then a conversation about the impact of Buried Truths, and then, yes, we meet Dorothy. Let's begin with Hank Klibanoff on stage with his welcome.
This is Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff. And I just want to take a picture of you tonight because this is a fantastic crowd and I'm so happy to see you and happy to be a part of this. I'm very grateful to WABE. They've made a production that is well beyond my wildest expectations. And I think that the crowd that's here tonight, the audience, and the number of people who come here is a testament to the fine production that they've put together. I'm also grateful to Emory University. We would not be here to begin with if they hadn't been behind this project. And it was an unusual pitch when I said, here's the way I'd like to teach this course. And they bought into it, and I've been grateful. So we're going to have a program tonight, and I'm going to invite out a couple of my colleagues here. Jan Berry, Director of Marketing at WABE. And Dave Barraswain, the producer. And
so just to echo what Hank said, we're so excited to see you all here. And so to kick off the program, I'm just going to have some time here with you guys and with Hank and Dave. And I want to start by asking you, Hank, what was it that drew you to this work?
As most of you probably know, I'm a journalist by training. I grew up in the South. It's no secret. I was born in 1949, entering first grade when the Brown versus Board decision was about to be enacted. If the state of Alabama, where I was being raised, had gone along with the mandate of Brown, I would have had the benefit and the privilege of having been in a diverse school system my entire schooling career. But of course, Alabama resisted, and it wasn't until I was nearly graduating from high school that we had the first desegregation. Those events crystallized my thinking about race in the South. I was 14 years old in 1963 when the bomb was detonated at 16th Street Baptist Church, killing three girls who were my age and a fourth girl who was younger. Those issues are dynamic in my mind. And during that whole time, some terrible things happened, and they are unresolved. They are unresolved because there was never justice. And even if there was a modicum of justice, it never went far enough. And I just feel like beyond that, as a storyteller, as a journalist, I just see this as just a rich opportunity to spread the knowledge of that I'm so fortunate to be able to explore with my students at Emory, and to share through this whole new, you know, way of storytelling, podcasting.
So can you guys start walking us through the process of, you've taught this as a class, but you're trying to make it into a podcast. And what did that entail, and kind of how'd you figure out how to tell the story?
Well, it was a learning experience. I'm used to, I loved long-form journalism. I used to write long stories. I like long sentences. Dave doesn't. He's paid not to. But it was just an opportunity to try something different. I thought, that's great. Everyone's podcasting now. I want in on that.
And the story, to tell the story, you have to find the principal players. And Hank and his students had already done so much research, had already found, from Dorothy, who we'll meet later, to other key people that were willing to help. There was a key character who we know as James Harris, was just instrumental in helping us down in Alston, and he knows Dorothy. And all of a sudden, these stories started to come together. And as myself and another producer, Kate Sweeney, started gathering these stories, you could see, once we developed a roadmap, it would come together.
So there's a term you kept throwing around in the office called D-Day. Can you tell us what D-Day was and why that was so critical to
the
podcast?
Well, D-Day is when you, myself, and there's a man in the corner named John Haas, who was our editor. He's standing in the back. Everybody, look. He was great in helping us to just get our ideas in order. But D-Day is when you take all of your individual snippets of audio that you can use, and you put them in order, or in this case, we tack them to a board and we get them all down in the way that they should go. And so we had 26 hours of tape that we had gone through, and we'd identified 257 assets, and we stacked the assets in the order that we should go, and then we wrote around those assets. Simple.
Yeah, right. We have, I can't tell you how much I appreciate what I learned about writing in this all new format from Dave. He cares about sound. He says, if we don't have sound, we don't have a podcast. And he didn't mean the sound that came out of my voice. Okay, he meant, recordings. He meant interviews, assets, we called them, recorded assets. And if you don't mind, David, and he may have taken this from someone else. I think he did credit someone else. He said,
it was me.
Right. He said, imagine you're in this forest with these specimen trees. He says, and you have to preserve the specimen trees. He says, we're going to write to the specimen trees. We're going to create a path that goes from specimen tree to specimen tree. And the specimen trees are the assets. They're the OMG moments, okay? WTF moments, okay? Right. And they are those things that we have to preserve. And Dave said, now, Hank, I'll be glad to go in and cut a dirt road from the trees, and build the narration that way. And then you come in and you pave the dirt roads.
Or make them longer.
Right. So
got it.
That's what we did.
So when you talk about certain clips, and I'm going to speak for myself, and I think a lot of the people in the audience, there were moments that just sunk in, and some of them hurt, and some of them made us smile. And I want to read from one listener comment. She said, to learn about slavery and racism in class, to read about it, was not anywhere as powerful as that one recording of Talmadge campaigning for governor. So can you tell us the story about how you found that clip? And then we actually have an extended version of that clip that we're going to share.
I think this clip was found from Georgia State University Archives. Mm-hmm. Producer Kate Sweeney found it, and when you ask for a piece of tape, they give you the full recording. So you have this one piece of Talmadge tape, or maybe two or three moments, but that comes from 4 hours of speeches. Some was from Columbus, I think there was something in Rome, And closer and closer they got towards that primary election date, the more animated Talmadge became in the clip. So we had to figure out what were we going to include. And the big thing was he was competing with a thunderstorm that was happening in the background. And he was getting to these points that he thought were very important, and they were all being interrupted by this thunderstorm. And then it became clear that members of the audience were leaving because of the rain that they saw coming or the rain that they feared. And so within this one clip, we just have to decide. We weigh the tape and we decide, you know what, this is how we're going to move forward with it.
In conclusion, let me put one more question to you. The FEPC is what they're trying to pass. That's to put foremans in your mills of any race or color. Yeah, looks like it's going to rain. You know that won't work in Georgia. And if you boys will get out next Wednesday in that election and join hands. Oh, it's great enough for all white men and white women to join hands. And what's breaking the opposition's heart? They know the majority of the white people in Muskogee County are for Talmadge. Let's get the great majority. And then come on to the convention in Macon, and there won't be anybody in that convention but white women and white men, if I'm your governor. Goodbye, I'm glad to see you.
It begins with harvesting records. And so it begins with a Freedom of Information Act request under the federal law to the FBI, to the Department of Justice. And so I filed that, seeking all federal records from the Department of Justice, FBI, on the killing of Isaiah Nixon. And of course, I get a response back that says, we have no such records from the FBI. We have no such records. And I thought, that's impossible. Because of the Gene Talmadge episode, I knew the state was swarming with FBI agents, even 2 years later in the 48 election. It just was not practical and logical and realistic to think there was no FBI paperwork on the killing of Isaiah Nixon for voting. So I appealed it, and they said, we still don't have the records, and what don't you get about that? So then I sent a request to the National Archives, and it's part of the dance you have to go through to get these records, which is not a pleasant task. And the National Archives, and I told them, this is urgent, my class starts in 4 weeks. you're my textbook. And so I had a great archivist who got on it, and he calls me back. He says, well, I found 185 pages. I said, kidding, are you serious? He said, yes. I said, where'd you get those? He says, the FBI. And then in the end, he sends me 235 pages. And there you can, that's a great start in building a narrative of what happens. And that's how, you know, we learn of Dorothy Nixon Williams, and we learn of Dover Carter, and we learn of Isaiah Nixon, of Dover Carter, and of John Harris. You know, three people who were the men who voted quite courageously.
And some subtle detail in there, too. We found this one bit of information from Sally Nixon when, in her statement to the FBI as we were going through it. We just found tiny little details, like of the two assailants that came to the house, one stayed at the car, one had to get to the house, and to do so he had to crawl under a wire fence to do it. And so we put those little pieces of color in there, and you'd be like, well, how did we know he had to climb under a wire fence? So all of that, all of these documents that we have, they can serve multiple purposes. Mm-hmm.
That's right. And then when we approach the families, and we'll talk more about that a little bit, but they were all on board. And not all families are. The season we're going to talk about later that we're having right now that we're working on, not everyone's open to talking about it, you know? But thank goodness that the Nixon family, the Dover Carter family, and the John Harris family were all happy to talk with us.
So I want to ask you as my final question about the ending. You talked about the specimen trees and the dirt roads, and how do you know when the roads stop?
Well, one thing we like to do is write to a destination so that you know how it's going to culminate. You write to that pathway and you don't meander. And so I talked to Hank about that, And he said, you know, Dave, the ending is going to present itself. It's going to present itself. So we kept painting and writing and getting there. And so I remember we were on this conference call with Hank and myself and the editor, and we were talking, and Hank said he was looking at a picture of the new marker for Isaiah Nixon. And I said, read the marker. What does it say? And I didn't see the picture. He was looking at it. And he said, well, it says, remember, what does it say exactly?
Our father, our hero, gets down to the bottom.
And as he's reading this to me over the phone, I said, Hank, that's our ending. We'll stop right there. Because it ends with the words, our hero. Like, that's all we need to hear.
And this is the marker that the Nixon family, Dorothy, led the family to put up in place of the one that had nothing on either side of it. I should point out that Dave wants to know the ending the first day we meet.
You have it?
He wants season two.
We want
and
the ending.
David, I want to let you know what the ending will be, okay?
All right.
It will present itself, okay?
We'll work on faith. It's fine.
Right.
Well, thank you both for all the work that you did to tell this story and to shine a light on the Nixon family, the Carter family, the Harris family. And I remember in episode one, you said you were going to tell us so much more, and you certainly did that. So thank you for your work.
You're listening to Buried Truths Live. Coming up in a moment, we meet Isaiah Nixon's daughter, Dorothy. But up next is Dr. Catherine Meeks, Executive Director of the Absalom Jones Episcopal Center for Racial Healing.
I came up with an expression in my own head that I couldn't decide if it was a cop-out or not, and I want you to help me on this. I said, you know, maybe it's if people, they may not have been racially motivated, but they were racially conditioned. The predisposition of white people to believe that a black person was acting criminally, so that they believed the Johnson brothers when they showed up at Isaiah Nixon's farm, and they said, well, we just went there to offer him a job, and he pulled a gun on us. I wanted to ask you about the racial conditioning of the South, because I grew up in a South that had all the racist jokes. I'm going to read you something, if I might, from a textbook that I came across recently that was in the elementary schools of Alabama back in when I was there, okay? And I can't swear that I actually read this particular book, but it's about the Ku Klux Klan. And it says, the loyal white men of Alabama saw they could not depend on the laws of the state government to protect their families. They knew they had to do something to bring back law and order, to get the government back in the hands of honest men who knew how to run it. It happened that at this time, a band of white-robed figures appeared on the streets of Pulaski, Tennessee. No one knew who they were. They rode through the town like ghosts and then disappeared. The Klan did not ride often, only when it had to. Okay? Whenever some bad thing was done by a person who thought the carpetbag law would protect them, the White Robe Klan would appear on the streets and, you know, make the bad people good again. You know, this is the kind of ridiculous literature that we were exposed to. How do we get past this racial conditioning that we were so immersed in for so many years?
Why don't you ask me something easy?
Take it wherever you want to go. You've got so much experience at this.
Well, let me just say that I have been doing this work of trying to see if we can find ways to become the human beings that God put us on the earth to be and to learn to live with one another as sisters and brothers. For the last 50 years of my life, I've been involved in this work since I was a kid in college. So it's not an academic thing for me. It's absolute vocation. This just so happened that I was able to teach African-American studies and make a living doing some of it, but I would have done the work regardless. And so I have also been preoccupied with the question of how do you grow up in a society, in a black body, and become the person you were put on the earth to be when you live in a country that has no interest in your well-being. And that's conditioning as well, conditioning for people, black people. So what we did in this country, and it didn't just start with us, we started way back in the 13th century, deciding that some people were better than other people. And we set up this supremacist model that says some people are better than other people, and those people that have white skin are better than people who don't have white skin. And we constructed this country on that premise. And then we had to do everything possible to keep explaining it. Because I believe from the bottom of my heart that there was something at the core of white people that didn't quite believe that was true. That there was this you know, like you've told all of this and all the structures around you bear witness to it, but there's that little spark inside of you that says, there's something not quite true about this, because to believe that you are so much better than anybody else and that anything that you do to people who don't look like you is okay because you're protecting yourself and your way of living, it's hard for me to believe that people bought that completely at the core. And I think some of the violence and some of the rage and some of the horrible stuff that we read about came out of people trying to make that little spark go away. That little uneasiness. You know how you do something when you're a little kid? You ever steal something? You know, and you kind of, you know, I mean, it's that it's you kind of.
A ball jotter.
Yeah, pen, you steal something it. And nobody saw you, but you kind of feel like maybe somebody did. And you don't quite ever feel quite the same. You don't feel the same way after you took it that you did before you took it. It's not enough to make you go confess. But you're uneasy. So I think there's an uneasiness. I think there's still an uneasiness in this supremacist paradigm that keeps tripping up white people. And the getting well is to start understanding that and understanding and saying yes to that uneasiness that says, no, I'm not going to set up categories and put some people in it and other people out of it. And then decide that anything I do to keep these categories discrete is good, right. I'm going to try to learn how to live to be a person who believes that everybody is equally worthy.
And there have been some wonderful instances of people who did terrible things begging for forgiveness and seeking forgiveness. I can't remember if we used it in the podcast or not, but the man from Rock Hill, South Carolina, Elwin Wilson, who showed up at Congressman John Lewis's office a few years ago and said, do you remember when the Freedom Ride bus came through Rock Hill? And John Lewis says, I remember up until the point that somebody hit me over the head with a club. And he says, well, that's why I'm here. That was me. And I want to apologize. Mm-hmm. And he sought forgiveness. And John Lewis was very good about forgiving him. There have been a number of instances on that. It hasn't caught like a rash. Yet, though we could stand some of that. And some of it may just be people at a certain age worried about whether they're going to go up or whether they're going to go down.
Well, I think we have to be careful. I'm a woman of faith. I believe in forgiveness. And I think that you live a better life if you don't go around harboring a bunch of bad stuff inside you toward other people. But I think we have to be careful that we don't take individual acts of forgiveness for collective liberation. So collectively, there's still there's still the supremacist paradigm, there's still the structures, there's still everything to try to keep that in place. So when this guy goes and talks to John Lewis, that's all very important. And I think that those acts interrupt negative energy. But we've got to interrupt enough negative energy so that we create a society where everybody is considered a worthy person. And so collectively, we still got a lot of work to do. Even though individual acts of forgiveness and forgiving has a whole lot to do with healing. And we do have to get well. But it's like you don't get to do either or. It's not like, oh, I'm going to get myself well and never mind the rest of the culture. You know, because that's not going to work either. So,
but this is the work you do, right?
That's the work I do. And if I probably had any good sense, I'd go off and make greeting cards or something. but I totally believe that we can be well if we decide we want to be well. I'm not totally convinced that the United States of America wants to be well. But I am convinced that we can be well. And if we decide we want to be well, then we have to decide that we're willing to do whatever it takes to get there. This kind of work helps to create a new narrative because we start telling the story with a different kind of energy. And every time we tell a story and there's some healing, we interrupt the negativity, the negative energy. So that's why we have been remembering people who were lynched in Georgia. So we just placed a marker at our center. We're across the street from Morehouse College, in case you want to know where we are, the Center for Racial Healing, the Absalom Jones Center. And we just placed a 5-foot piece of granite with 4 bronze plates with all the names of people who were lynched in Georgia on that marker to interrupt the negative narrative. And to say to those folks who were lynched, we're calling your names. Maybe some healing goes back to them, but some healing definitely comes to us as we stand there and do that, interrupting the negative. So when you talk about your struggling with this conditioning, it's part of the fabric. And you just have to keep interrogating yourself. You know, bell hooks talks about that. You have to interrogate yourself, question yourself. You know, I've catch myself thinking some thought about somebody and realizing I'm making this stuff up in my head. I don't know anything about them. You know, you're driving down the road, you see somebody driving a certain kind of car, and you start telling yourself about them, and you don't know a thing about them. You're just making it up. And that's what we do around race. You know, white people have been told a lot of stuff, and they make up stuff about certain groups of black people. I mean, look at us now. We're acting so stupid. White people calling the cops on somebody black falling asleep in the library. Who in here has gone to school and didn't fall asleep in the library? You know? So I think that we've got, you know, we just got to get a grip.
Thank you so much, Dr. Meeks. Welcome. This is wonderful.
Thank you.
You're listening to Buried Truths Live. Up next, we'll meet Isaiah Nixon's daughter, Dorothy, and we'll take questions from the audience.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org. Support for WABE comes from 100 Miles, a nonprofit committed to preserving Georgia's 100-mile coast. Protecting this critical coastal ecosystem takes all of us. Watch the stories of the innovators and future leaders who help keep our coast flowing at OurGeorgiaCoast.org.
In this final part of Buried Truths Live, Dorothy and Hank talk about her life and the impact the Buried Truths podcast has had. You'll notice she makes references to her children, Tony and Joy, and also to her grandmother, and even to her mother, Isaiah Nixon's wife, Sally Nixon.
I'd like to introduce you to Dorothy Nixon Williams.
Nice, huh?
Super nice.
I just want to open up by asking, why, when we first called you, why were you so open to letting us, and maybe you didn't know how far it was going to go, but letting us come into your life to hear a story that was so uncomfortable for you?
I've never told Hank this before, and I want you to know as a group too right now, I'm a little emotional, as some of you can see. When I heard his voice and the sincerity and what he wanted to do, I said I needed to go, and I did talk to my children about it and so forth, and I should go. When I met the class, and they looked just like I see some of your faces, they were so excited and ready to hear what I had to say. And they had done quite a bit of work before they met me. I talk about feeling a release, but I began to feel it. And then I just wanted to do more for them and to be honest, to do more to help myself get through this. So I'm so happy that they selected my father to do all the work that they did.
Well, thank you. You don't know when you're making that initial call to someone. It's a very awkward position to be in to say, hello, my name is Hank Klibanoff. That's a problem to begin with, okay? You know, it's not George Smith, okay? I teach at Emory University, and I never say the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases class because that's just too much for anybody to take in, you know? And I have a group of students who are examining Georgia history, and I'm trying to get to it, you know, and finally say, and we're examining a case from 1948 in which yada, yada, yada. And if I got that call, I'd like to think I would be as open as Dorothy was. And it was just extraordinary. It sort of set the course of what we did, you know. But the pain for you was still there when I called. And I guess I was wondering if once we first talked to you, if that unleashed memories that you hadn't really been thinking about for a long time.
Well, one thing I want you all to know, I thought about it quite often, but I didn't relieve some of the feelings that I had about it. And that was it. And over time, I could tell that it was hurting me emotionally, too. I've always told people that once I was able to go to work and get all my personal ideas out of my mind and do what I had to do, but I'll be honest with you, it stayed with me all my life into old age, because when Hank met me, I was in old age. But I needed to talk about it. And that, looking at that group, just like looking at you all and seeing the interest and so forth, it just helps a whole lot to just be free from that. It's out of my heart, the forgiveness is there, and so forth. And I just think about how I feel that it was meant to be, that Daddy wasn't forgotten, and he is being used to help a lot of people, and hopefully it will help a lot of you in here that have not thought about some of the pain that persons like me have been through and carried that pain, because they didn't have counselors in 1948 to help me get through. So I isolated myself and just studied and had a couple of teachers that helped me, and my grandmother. She wasn't a lot of words, and my daddy was her only child. She was a quiet woman. She didn't talk that much, but just her presence all the time. And she would take me in the yard and she could feel my pain, and she didn't say a lot of words, but we were communicating. That's why I can't tell anybody today, well, what did she say? She didn't say much, but just her calmness and the feelings that were there helped me get through quite a bit.
But it's also what made you such an empathetic nurse, psychiatric nurse, right?
Yes. Well, my grandmother wanted me to be a nurse. I really wanted to be a pianist. You know, I played the piano.
If I had remembered that, I'd have brought one out here. It's one thing to agree to help some students on a project like this, but another one when you get the call to say, by the way, we're thinking of making a podcast out of this. And if you're like me, when you at that stage, you would say what many of us did say at the time, how do I watch one, you know? And but you were very game, and then there was this really interesting moment that came up when we're doing the podcast and we, you know, you need a logo, you need some sort of symbol of it, and we had that gorgeous picture of your father that you had shared with us. And his eyes just, you just fall into his eyes. It's just fantastic. And we want it to run a bar over his eyes and another one over his mouth. And y'all have all seen that. And there was a part of me that when I had to make this call and ask her and say, I want to send you something to look at, but first I want to tell you what it is. And I think her impulse, first impulse, as mine was, no, I don't think so. It just, it takes a too gorgeous picture and it just seems to blaspheme it in some way. Can you tell us how you came to okay that?
Well, really, simply put, when Hank explained how they came up with the idea of why he was covered, I talked to Joy, I talked to Tony, and Joy was the one that really, she said, Mama, I can really visualize that concept, and I think that will be great. And I said, okay.
And then,
but she was very instrumental in helping me, along with Hank, to understand what it meant. Because I just thought you were just covering him.
Well, I wasn't sure we weren't. but I was worried about it. But then I think that, again, I'm praising the marketing people who did this, but the way they took the bars so on and put it on a little short video where they came off his eyes to expose the real face, I thought was just a brilliant move, you know. So tell me what reaction you've heard, if any, from the podcast. I guess most people in your world in Jacksonville don't even know necessarily that it's you.
Well, persons around me, family, at church, and then certain people called that I work with or I just knew in the community. And then my beautician said, every time I listen, I just boo-hoo cried. Then other people said, I just cried every time I listened. And then somebody said, on the way to work, I just listened all the way there and all the way back. So I got a lot of good feedback from people around me. And I'm not a big... I know how to use social media pretty good because of mainly my daughter, because she would not let me not be able to do things. As a matter of fact, when Hank called and asked me if I knew how to do FaceTime,
right,
I said, yeah, I know how to do it.
Well, I'm going to tell the story on myself.
We're
at the gravesite, and we've made this, it's just staggering what we are looking at, you know. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, well, we have to call Dorothy. And I said, do you know how to FaceTime? She says, well, yeah. And I said, because I don't. And I said, I think I have to hang up and call you back. And the students all jumped in, no, don't hang up. You know, just push that button, you know. And so then we were able to do that, you know. So.
And I think you said the students were surprised that I knew how to.
Yeah, right. They knew you were older than me, you know, so. Q&A first. All right. If you have questions, there'll be a floating mic. Here we go.
Hello. I'm Rhiannon Evangelista, and I have a question for Dorothy Nixon Williams. And my question has to do with that meeting with Keith Johnson. And I was wondering... Well, it seems to me from the way I listen to the podcast, from the way I hear it, that Keith got quite a lot out of it. But I was wondering what your reaction was. Did it help you in your process? Did it not? Or was your process of coming more to terms with your experiences fairly complete by that point?
By the time I met Keith, I had been asked twice. The first time I said I was not ready, so I didn't meet him. The second time, which was some time later, I told Hank, yes, I'm ready. So when I met Keith, I was ready. I was not going to meet him if I felt like I wasn't, because then my reaction wasn't going to be like I wanted it to be. For him, because it wasn't Keith's fault. And the sincerity that I received from him. He was such a wonderful person, and we talked quite a long time. But no, I wasn't going to meet him if I felt like I wasn't going to be open to him.
No. I'll say this. When he walked in the door at her place, you don't know how that's going to go, right?
I think Hank was more afraid than me.
But he stood there, and his first words were, "Let's have a hug." And that sure helped.
I want to say that the story of your father is so inspiring, and he was a hero. And for me as an activist, it means so much to think about what he died for. But I want to ask how you feel in 2018, knowing that the voter suppression, the voter intimidation tactics are still happening.
I'm disappointed because I didn't realize that so much of it was still in the hearts of people. I thought we had gotten a little further than we are today, just watching the voting and all of those things. But I'm still optimistic that it's going to get better. And the more we do something like this, and the more we become involved, and the more that we really deep down think about how we really feel, and that we don't have to go along with people that still feel the way that they felt in 48 and 2018. Yeah. So I was disappointed, but it's going to get better. And I do believe that we are not going to go back to those days that almost 100% of people, especially people of color, were persecuted.
Good evening. My name is Kim Ramsey White. I'm a faculty member at Georgia State University, and I teach health disparities in public health. And I just want to—I don't really have a question. I just want all of you to know really how impactful that podcast has been. I use it in my class, and as a way, particularly when I talk about disparities, I use the slogan to start out with: in order to understand who we are now, we have to understand who we were then. And one of the things that really came out of my class this semester in talking about that was how far we really haven't come. And I think people think that, particularly some of the students in this generation, feel like, you know, we have this whole neo-racial place that we're in. And so much of what we've seen this particular political, during this particular political time, in conjunction with listening to your podcast, has just really made things more real and realistic as far as my students are concerned. So at the end of the day, all I really want to say is thank you. Thank you for putting out a medium in such a way that gives us an opportunity to really talk about the past and to put it into perspective in terms of where we are now.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. My question regards the fifth episode of the podcast. In the fifth episode, we learn that Robert Mueller, then the FBI director, was responsible for reopening these racial cold cases. And my question for each and every one of you, and I hope that you would, Dr. Meeks, Mr. Klibanoff, and Ms. Nixon-Williams, will all lend your individual perspective on the role of law enforcement and the legal system, the courts as well, on voter suppression, both then and now.
I want to clarify one thing, and this is part of what I know and part of what I think. The day that then Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez called a press conference to announce that the Department of Justice and the FBI were launching their Civil Rights Cold Case Initiative. This was in the end of 2006. And they said, he said, and this came after a successful federal prosecution of two men in Mississippi for torturing and killing two young men, Charles Moore and Henry Hezekiah D. in Mississippi. And General Gonzalez was so taken by the story and by the successful prosecution, though most of, I will tell you, most of the work was done by a Canadian broadcast reporter and by the brother of Charles Moore, that they then turned over to the FBI and to the U.S. attorney in Jackson, Mississippi. They successfully prosecuted. He said, gosh, are there other cases? And the answer was yes. And he said, let's have an initiative. And certainly Robert Mueller was there that day, and he made his comments. I will tell you that as the weeks and months went on, you will not find a whole lot of evidence that the FBI did a whole lot, other than to see, as they should have, if this case, if the perpetrators are dead, if there are no living witnesses, then we are going to close the case and bring closure to the families. They shouldn't be holding on to this. In many cases, the families had no idea that there had been an FBI case to begin with, okay? The FBI did not in 1948, 52, 62, 68, go around to families and say, by the way, here are the findings of our investigation into the death of your father, your grandfather, your uncle. So many didn't even know that their case had been reopened. Now he's reopening it, but they're very quickly closing them. And the entire time since 2006, or seven, when it really became official, the FBI did not initiate a single case that had not been previously told and revealed by journalists. Today, as you're asking about today, if anybody wants to speak on the role of law enforcement on this, on voter suppression, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that law enforcement should prosecute voter suppression.
Well, I think the courts need to deal with when people are breaking the law, they need to be held accountable. And so, and the sad thing is that our legal system, I don't think it's a justice system at all, doesn't do all of the stuff it needs to be doing. But it does better in 2018 than it did in 1948. I mean, that's where where I always find myself coming back to. But when people, you know, if I break the law, I'm held accountable. So there shouldn't be some people that get to break the law and not be held accountable, and we see a lot of that happening, and that's really distressing to see that happening, and it's going to keep on happening until we get a lot of other stuff fixed.
I do think there's always the question, the reasonable question to be asked, and we will be asking that in the second season: if people had been prosecuted back then, how might things be different now?
Yeah.
Good evening. My name is Pamela Perkins, and I'm actually Dr. Meeks Dorothy. I'm actually, my father is Aunt Sally's nephew. And so I'm sorry I missed the family reunion, but Charles had a stroke, so that's what I was busy doing. But I just want to say there was a statement made about Uncle Isaiah being lost to the family. I grew up in Uvalde, Georgia. I grew up in Montgomery County. And I have heard about Uncle Isaiah as long as I can remember. And he was the inspiration for me in doing the social justice work that I do. And all of the things, and Aunt Sally has been just a strong example of a strong black woman. And so we thank you, Dorothy, for bringing this to everyone else.
Hi, I just want to say thank you also, and I want to say, growing up in the 60s, I remember in school studying U.S. history that we always included the stories of Studs Terkel and the working class white people. And so now that we are in the age of alternative facts and bare truth, in the textbooks that children use today, I'm wondering if opportunities will be available for teachers to come and learn this history so that they can integrate that into the school work that the children are learning, because it's not in the history books and it will never be in the history books.
I'm going to ask Jan, would you come out and help respond to that? Sure. Jan Berry, Director of Marketing.
Hi. So yes, we are actually working on that diligently, and we'll be releasing lesson plans in the coming weeks. So we have been working. We've been working, we actually partnered with the Georgia Department of Education, which was really important, and they selected four teachers, two eighth grade social studies teachers, and two high school US history teachers from across the state of Georgia who they thought were best equipped. I think two of them are here, the Coles. And so they've been working on figuring out basically how does this podcast become source material and what are the best ways to integrate it. The fantastic part is, you know, at the beginning when we were working with the DOE, they asked, what's your goal? And I said, our goal is for teachers to use it. And we don't have these other standards that we want to meet, whatever needs to be the case, because we know what it's like for teachers, right? And so the lesson plans are aligned to the Georgia Standard of Excellence curriculum. They are modular so that a teacher can do a whole four-day lesson, or they can take a lesson here and there if they just want to teach one aspect of it. Mm. It also is applicable to people in other states as well, so we'll be sure everyone knows that. And if you're not already connected with us, you can connect with us on Facebook. Let us know if you want to be added to our Berry Truths newsletter, and we'll be letting everybody know when those are coming out, where you can download them. And any help that you can provide in your communities, if you're teachers yourselves, to let people know they're available, we really appreciate. Thanks. That's
wonderful.
Okay, I think I know one more thing I'm going to do now. This coming Saturday in Jacksonville, when the whole family gathers to celebrate Sally's 95th birthday, we're going to sing one stanza of Happy Birthday. And they're going to film it, and you can show it to her, all these people who were here to celebrate her birthday, okay? Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Sally. Thank you for coming tonight. Thank you for a wonderful evening. Particularly thank you, Dr. Meeks.
You're welcome.
And especially Dorothy Nixon Williams, who we've all fallen in love with on the air, and now we can fall in love with in person. Yeah. Okay? So thank you so much. Y'all have a good evening.
You've been listening to Berry Truths Live, a program recorded in November 2018 at the Atlanta History Center. All right, so quick announcement. Season 2 of Berry Truths is coming. The season will be released in mid-February, and you'll probably start hearing about it in your feeds towards the beginning of February. So look out and don't miss it. I promise you're going to love it. We'd like to say thank you to Dorothy and Joy for traveling from Jacksonville to spend time with us for this event. Thanks to Keith Johnson and Ellie Studdard, who couldn't attend in person but contributed from afar. Thanks also to the Atlanta History Center for hosting us. And thank you to the Berry Truths podcast team that made this event possible. Robert Jones, David Bereswain, Christine Dempsey, Ayana Taylor, Alita McCalman, Jared Blass, Sheila Oliver, John Haas, Hillary Silverboard, and Wanya Lucas. Thanks also to our volunteers. We're so grateful to everyone who attended. I'm J.N. Berry, and we have one last thanks. That's to you. Thank you for listening to Berry Truths, a production of WABE, Atlanta.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary, but when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.